You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Wayne Fritz, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of the Concierge Coaches Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with my co-host, Wayne Fritz. Wayne,
hey, good
to see you in there. So we got the dream team today. We have a special guest with us today. Special guest, Dr. Susan Giddings. Oh my gosh, this is going to be such a great show. Let me tell you something, folks. This show is about coaching and self-improvement, but one of the things that kind of you guys get to see real time through what I've been doing post-retirement, what Wayne's been doing with his career, this is yet again another testament to how you can go from one career, apply the knowledge, some of the knowledge that you had in that career, into a marvelous private sector situation, whether that be a consulting role and or, yes, co-author of a book. And Dr. Giddings is the lead author on this marvelous book on unlocking federal time credits. We're going to explain what that is and what that means. And Wayne, if you have any questions, just raise your hand, because it's going to be, it might get a little technical here with some of these federal things. But anyway, well, Susan, thanks for coming on the show.
Great to be here. So this is a first for me, particularly in post-retirement, but a first in general. So
yes, I was talking to my family members, and I said, now it was 1991 that you and I first met at the federal prison that was currently at the Air Force Base at Seymour Johnson Air Force Base in Goldsboro, North Carolina, in 1991, Wayne. And there I was, TDY.
We were both kids then.
We were kids then. I was TDY for a guy named Jack McWay, who was the psychologist at the time, and he was out of the institution for an extended period. Never forget Warden Frank Woods. And the guy was a mystery. He'd look different every time. I said, what was your name again, sir? I'm the warden, damn it. What a good first impression I made.
But you know, if he ever took his notebook out of his pocket and started writing, you better be paying attention.
And then he's on the treadmill next to me at the workout center, you know, not looking very wardenly. And there he was again. Anyway, nice guy. Loved that guy. I think he loved me toward the end of the tour of duty, and that was fun. And then Susan and I
gave me a shot as a case manager.
Yes, he did. And then Susan and I, you know, promoted up through various assignments. We then landed in the same prison in 1994. Yeah. Susan was, I'm going to say, the case manager at the federal women's prison at Carswell. She was at the camp, virtually running the camp. I know we had Yvonne and some other people in there, but let's face it, me and Susan would hold team and get those campers straight, right, Susan?
Yeah, it was a good time. Yeah, and that was an adjustment too, going from a men's facility to working in a women's facility. That was new for both of us as well.
Couldn't get out of there quick enough, Susan. My God, working with women's the next level.
Has its own challenges.
That's another show.
There you go.
Susan, I guess then, Susan, talk about your various assignments post-Carswell and kind of give us a thumbnail.
Sure. So I stayed in case management correctional programs my entire career. Again, I was a case manager at Carswell, was at Carswell for about 7 years, moved on to the United States Penitentiary in Lee County, Virginia, activated that as a case management coordinator. Again, new experience, got to kind of expand from just working a caseload to really, you know, establishing policy and procedures, local procedures and for the institution. And spent 11 years there. And I went on to be the senior correctional program specialist in the Mid-Atlantic region. And,
I got to stop you there real quick. Mm-hmm. Good. Folks, Susan has something that I don't have and a lot of other correctional Susan has a tour of duty at a penitentiary. At a USP. folks, you don't understand the level of violence and destruction and death and lockdowns and calamity and crisis. So for you to be at a USP complex, I mean, my hat's off to you. Thank you for your service. That's Wayne, that's like staying in Iraq for 11 years. I mean, as a matter of fact, she probably saw more action at that prison than our soldiers did in Iraq. I ain't gonna lie. So, once again, I don't want that to go missed.
I wouldn't go that far, but it was, I did get my education in gang management and understanding who doesn't get along with whom. Yeah. And so it was a great expansion on my correctional program's knowledge and base. So, I was there for 11 years and then went on to the Mid-Atlantic Regional Office in Maryland as a senior correctional program specialist. Gave me, again, an expansion of my correctional program's knowledge, working with the central office and public affairs and legislative affairs and our designation folks and population management and, kind of got to see a bigger picture of what it is to be in the Bureau. Sometimes, working in the institution, we're focused on just what's going on in our neighborhood, in our house. And so moving up to the region was a great training ground. And after there, spent, like I said, about 7 years there. And then just Christmas week of 2019 was moved on to central office, Washington, D.C., and was the unit management section chief in the correctional programs branch. And that's where I finished out my career, spent just about 4 years, a little over 4 years there before I stepped out into the retirement world.
Susan, can I ask a question?
Sure.
This may be out left field, but it just tweaked my interest, I guess, when Bruce was talking, because I never knew. But what's the difference in your duties, or what's the difference in working in a federal prison? I thought they were the same, and a penitentiary. I mean,
right. So all of our prisons are federal prisons. A minimum security satellite camp, like our federal prison camp, where like Bruce and I were at, is a standalone facility. Minimum security inmates, nonviolent offenders, drug offenders, white collar criminals, that kind of stuff. You then move up to the what we call FCIs, Federal Correctional Institutions, which are either lows or mediums. And as the name implies, it is low security offenders and then medium security offenders. And, some of our low security offenders are there. Maybe they got some violence in their background. Maybe they have a more lengthy criminal past. Or maybe they've worked their way down from a more serious institution and have done a lot of time and gotten a little older and have started racking up the points to move down to lesser security. Okay. And then penitentiaries are our high security facilities. Those are typically predominantly violent offenders, gang members, drug offenders, but drug offenders with significant networks, a lot of violence in their background. Maybe their current offense isn't violent, but their previous offenses were violent. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, like I said, gang members and folks like that. Or folks at a lower level and work their way up through misconduct in the institution.
Okay, that makes sense. I was raised in a little old bitty town in Illinois, Danville. And 30 years ago, they built a prison. And I think it's a medium to minimum or something, but it's on the outskirts of the town I grew up in. And I've had several relatives and friends that, went to work out there, and they've already retired after many years. But I remember when it was brand new. So I just was trying to distinguish, and thank you. You made that very clear. Thank you.
Sure.
So in other words, the book that you two have put together, that would kind of give, if someone was in a penitentiary, say, but they wanted to get better, Jesus was in the corner talking to them. And so somebody gave them that book that would help them learn how to get better and maybe get those points or something to get.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. So the book really covers everything there is to know about federal time credits, which was a brand new benefit that was authorized under the First Step Act, which was passed in 2018, at the end of 2018. And it established some new things for the Bureau, and it incorporated some existing things. So this part of it focuses on those new elements of the pattern risk assessment, recidivism risk assessment, the Spark 13 needs assessment tool, and then time credits, which is just the gold medal of the First Step Act, which is the ability to earn credits to reduce your sentence up to 12 months, and then also potentially earn additional credits that can be applied for an early halfway house.
So in other words, and I'm sorry I keep burrowing here, but so realistically, if I'm in a penitentiary, and I want to get better. Something happened, and it's a serious thing. So I read this book, and then I start talking. Do I have a caseworker when I'm in?
Absolutely. All folks in the system, in the inner prison system, are assigned to a case manager.
So I would talk to my case manager and find out, what can I do? How am I doing? And what else can I do to get point credit and to do this? Because I want to do everything I can do so that you can do everything that you can do.
Absolutely. And the really interesting part when it comes to pattern is the pattern recidivism risk tool that is part of the First Step Act is separate from security designation and custody classification. So it's two different instruments, which really confuses folks, but it's two different things. So you can actually still be in a penitentiary, but working your way down on the pattern side, because pattern recidivism risk is about how you're going to do when you go home. Your pattern risk level can be dropping even if your security level hasn't yet dropped. They're two systems. There's overlap, but they are two separate systems.
Okay. Boy, this is very interesting.
It is, you know, so basically, you know, the inmate goes into the prison. They take all these surveys and assessments. The Bureau of Prisons then kind of rates them, if you will, on these instruments, and then also kind of gives them like a college curriculum of possible classes, evidence-based programs for them to participate in while they're in prison. Also, meaningful activities such as work or some other activities in the program also count toward this. So I know that some of the prisons have a lot of programs. Some of the prisons don't. So as long as the inmate is on a waiting list or they're showing interest in the opt-in or they're in the earning category, that's fine. And so, yeah, this is a real interesting phenomenon, Wayne, because there's a lot of folks with short sentences. And Susan and I put Susan to the test the other day. I'm like, Susan, this guy got sentenced with 21 months. What do you think, right? Because he's earning this way, and his time is coming that way, right? And so there's this area, right, toward before the end and after the beginning, where the person could be in a halfway house. The person might be in home confinement, wearing an ankle monitor, serving the rest of their sentence at home. And so this is something that a lot of inmates are interested in. I mean, every inmate's interested in that, but particularly the guys and ladies with these shorter sentences, because what happens is that they'll be in a halfway house and still earning time off their sentence. Yes. Wow. And so, you know, that's of interest, but also, you know, having this knowledge from this book available on Amazon. Also, con las palabras en español también. We have a Spanish version. So, right? And so then they can understand, you know, it empowers the family. It empowers the inmate.
Yes.
Shoot, this is empowering defense lawyers to know what's going to happen when the gavel slams, and now the person's in under the care of the executive branch of government. A lot of these attorneys, they just kind of go up to sentencing and that's it. They're done. They really don't interact with the inmates. They don't really understand post-conviction procedures. And that is something that I identified when I retired back in 2013 and I saw ex-inmates in the consulting space. And then it was actually, I'm going to say it, Miss Newman, who's now a warden, was working with me side by side and said, hey, you ought to be a consultant. You know what I mean? If these people are. And I thought, you know what? You're right. And then I had the fortune of working alongside, Jose Santana. He was active here in set 2017, 18, 19. And we have a couple of other guys, Mike and Scott that are with us as consultants and kind of fill in from time to time. So yeah, it's a real blessing to be there, but it's also just a huge blessing that, I mean, I have a layman's understanding of this, but, you know, by being kind of exposed to it since 2018. But Susan actually, Susan, go ahead and drill in a little bit about your role in central office.
Sure. Yeah. So, and before I say, I just wanted to go back in terms of what Bruce was saying is, in terms of this and some other projects Bruce and I are working on net coming up, we are the attorneys. I've had multiple occasions when I was working in an institution where an individual approaches me with a question and the first thing he says is, but my attorney told me, and I have to break it to them. You know, well, I'm sorry, your attorney's not your case manager, and let me explain how this works, or how jail credit works, or your instant offense and how that's scored, and those kind of all those issues. So this was something Bruce and I talked about as kind of our first joint venture. As I said, I was in central office in the unit management section, and unit management section chief. FSA had passed prior to me coming on, and for those of you who might be familiar with the law, there was some benchmarks in terms of things coming online. And some of that stuff happened before I was on board. In late 19, just prior to me changing, we were out doing training in the field. We'd come together and had a training plan put together, and we did in-person training with every site in the agency. And then there was an election. And the implementation plan that the previous administration had for FSA and time credits and the current administration, they had two different ideas. And so we really started from scratch. And so now I was in central office and I was working with drafting policy, drafting training material. And of course, then the pandemic happened and that just made life super, super interesting. But yeah, so we were doing just, I was directly involved with kind of figuring out how the new administration wanted things implemented, writing the policy that was later published, working with our computer programmers and kind of troubleshooting, taking correctional program stuff and them applying it into an IT world and, just every aspect of it. So, and then working directly with staff and training and troubleshooting when issues from offenders came up to us.
Now, Susan, I want you to, you know, hopefully you'll pick up on this. I'm going to set this up. Hopefully you'll be able to carry it through for me.
Sure.
We have a Facebook community called Early Release, First Step Act, Early Release from Federal Prison. Right now it's just under 8,000 families and inmates. Very big community we have on Facebook. Now, from time to time, we get comments that say, well, politics has nothing to do with this. Oh, my God. Politics has everything to do with this. Politics decides the tone of the implementation of this policy. There's enough latitude. It's not black and white as a lot of you folks think out there. You know, and Susan, there's an example of what? how it was like, it's not forwarded, but it's earned, but it's earned, but not, you know what I mean? And remember, there was a difference before.
Sure, absolutely. So when it was first rolled out in 2018 and in 2019, under the Bar Attorney General Office, the Bar Administration, time credits were going to be earned based on 8-hour days of programming. So if we have a 500-hour program, we were dividing it by 8, which is 62.5. And those 60 days got to get time credits, two intervals of time credits, 30 and 30. And the 2.5 days got kind of held over for whatever the next program was. And individuals weren't going to get credit until they completed the class. So looking at a 500-hour program, which takes upwards of 9 months because they're not working 8 hours a day, 5 days a week in programming. So we're talking about 9 months. And depending on when in their sentence they completed it, they would have earned maybe 20 or 30 days of credit. And that's it. So then there's an election. And as we all know, elections have consequences. We got a new administration in the Department of Justice, and they approach the whole topic of time credits from a completely different mindset. We went from this very strict, very structured, specific classes, specific number of hours, et cetera, to what I described as a faucet on, faucet off type scenario. Either you were in earning status and the credits were programming days were accumulating toward the earning of credits, or you weren't in earning status. When I was doing training with case managers and case management coordinators, I had the image of a faucet, and I was like, it's either on or off. There is nothing in between. It is no longer about those individual classes and those individual hours. And so that was a complete paradigm shift, and it was hard for the staff, the employees. It was hard for folks on the outside. It was hard for our offenders. Even today on the Facebook page, I periodically will see questions about, well, I've taken this class and now I'm taking this class, and do I get more credit? And it's not about that class. It is about you as an individual making that good faith effort toward improving yourself and working your way through these programs. So like I said, you're either in earning status or you're not. And there is no in between. There's no ish.
No. Nope.
And that was all politics. All nope. Politics.
And so we'll see what the new election brings, and we're excited to see. But you never know. You know, you just never know what anybody's going to do. But I can be assured, I think we can all be assured, there'll be some changes. So this is an interesting thing. One thing I want to bring up, I know it's a little bit technical, but it's also coming up. Now, if there's a short sentence inmate, let's say 30 months or less, there's the person, if they're in opt-in status and low risk or minimal risk, they're going to be earning these time credits, okay? But the question is, hey, should I go ahead and take the residential drug abuse treatment program if I'm eligible? Now, ladies and gentlemen, the residential drug abuse treatment program, until First Step Act happened, that was the only way you got a year off your sentence. I mean, that was it. Like that was the only program, and everybody was gunning and running, and people that didn't have drug problems said, I have a drug problem. You know, everybody's trying to get in that program, right? So they can maybe get a year off their sentence. Now, with the advent of the First Step Act, now we have all these other people getting, right, 150 days your first year. Was it 2 years and 1 or 2 months? You've got a full year off your sentence, and then you could be even earning more toward RRC, halfway house placement. So it's really interesting. I'll let Susan pick the baton up there. Susan, so yeah, what do you say to some of those folks that say, you know what, screw it. I'm not going to take RDAP. I'm going to get this FSA anyway. Why should I take RDAP?
So I will first speak from my case manager perspective. And my case manager perspective is, if you have a substance abuse problem, then you get in the program. I mean, it's to adopt a philosophy of, well, I don't want to work that hard and I'm going to get the time off anyway. over here. Well, that's what we call criminogenic thinking. And that's the kind of thing that actually gets you back in prison. So I am always, always, always going to say, if you have a problem and you have the time to take the program, then take it. Now, let's talk about the benefit on the RDAP, the 3621E release benefit. That's the official statutory section. If you are earning time credits and you are eligible for 3621E release benefit, you're going to get both. If you have enough time, you can get up to 2 years off of your sentence. Something else to think about. Post-COVID and the CARES Act, space in halfway houses is at a premium. There are probably some places in the middle of corn country that have space available. But if you are looking at a halfway house that were, you know, is anywhere near an urban center.
As we speak right now, and I'm sorry to interrupt, right now, and I'm just ever so familiar with Houston because that was my territory. The Houston halfway house, which is really big, really, really, really big, as in several hundreds of folks, is full. So, I mean, people are really having to fight to get just a basic placement in even an urban center like Houston, Texas. That's one of the more larger halfway houses in the system. Please carry on.
Yeah. Absolutely. So in order to benefit from 3621E, from the RDAP early release benefit, you have to be in a halfway house for a minimum of 120 days. If you are looking at, if you have a shorter sentence, and by shorter, I mean 30 months, you have time to complete RDAP. You have time to get time credits. But because you have a 30-month sentence, you will not have enough time to earn 365 days toward the First Step Act, which means the only halfway house placement you're getting is under the Second Chance Act. And under the Second Chance Act, the Bureau has the discretion, taking into account eligibility, appropriateness, and community resources, meaning beds available, to give you anywhere from 0 days to 12 months. RDAP individuals, folks who have completed RDAP, will, at a minimum, get 120 days. And because if they're eligible for that time off and they have to do 120 days, they will get preference over someone who is just looking at a Second Chance Act placement. So should you do RDAP? Absolutely. Are there benefits? Yes. It's a great program. It is probably, the Bureau is the largest provider of substance abuse treatment nationally. Wow. We have more beds, more folks and more treatment providers, et cetera, et cetera. So if you can benefit from the program, that's great, but why not take advantage of it? On the street, that kind of residential program, one, isn't going to exist. You're not going to have a residential program for 9 months. But if you truly need the help and need to get clean and want to stay clean and want to stay out of prison, that's where you need to be. That is my soapbox. It is not a time off program, but if you benefit from it.
Right. And just so let's be clear, bank robbers, pedophiles, whoever qualifies can get in there. They may or may not get the year off, but they can get in and get the treatment. It's not the time off program. It is a residential drug program. So make no mistake about it. People that aren't eligible for the year off still get into the program every day. So we're not precluding. We're not, you know, everybody that qualifies gets in. So, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that was really good. And again, in this post-COVID era, you know, we talk about the CARES Act, and the CARES Act was something that was a scramble. And while all these people were sick, we had to make these decisions. They had to make all these decisions of you know, letting these people out, sometimes, gosh, 6 or 7 years on an ankle monitor, 6 or 7 years on home confinement to finish out their sentence. That's a long time. And granted, we needed to get the prisons as vacated as possible, whatever, to handle the COVID numbers. But what that did was, is that it created a lack of home confinement monitors because a lot of them are already taken till 2028. And so these new inmates coming out now in 2024, 2025, 2026, like, hey, man, I'm home confinement eligible. That doesn't mean you're necessarily going to get it, right? Because one, you have to have the monitoring device, and two, some of the staffing components are cut short in the residential reentry centers. Man, when you're doing home confinement, somebody from the RRC has to check on you. They've got to call you. You've got to come in and piss in a cup once a week at least. You know, it's still staff. Staff are still checking on you, and it requires staff time. I think a lot of people think, well, if I'm on home confinement, staff have to don't do crap. No, they still got to do crap. The halfway house, they still got to do this and that, and it's still, part of their labor force. And again, only 20% can be on home confinement. So it's not as if, like, you know, everybody's going to get it. So there is this 20% quota that the Bureau likes to see. But again, there's a big difference, I think, sometimes, y'all, on what you're eligible to get and what you get. And if you don't get something, a lot of people will be like, you're breaking the law. I'm going to sue you. No. You know what I mean? They're not breaking the law. They're just in a understaffed, underfunded situation.
So even if you're at home with an ankle monitor for 7 years, that is really probably more labor intensive for the institution than it is if they're in there.
Well, it's labor intensive from the standpoint that folks who are in halfway house and home confinement are under the residential reentry management branch. And we're going to have one office, and we have 22 offices nationwide. And so that one office, who probably has a staff of about 6-7 people, maybe if they're lucky, is monitoring halfway houses, those contracts, for 15-20 different sites, maybe more, maybe less. And they're working with contractors, folks from Salvation Army and Volunteers of America and things like that. So they're having to monitor these contracts and making sure that our contract providers in the communities are doing all the things they need to do. So they're not only monitoring the offenders who are in these different, the halfway houses at home confinement, but they're also monitoring the contractors. So for those RRM offices, they are doing a ton of work. And just to kind of follow up on something Bruce mentioned about the CARES Act, and again, how politics plays a role. Under the Barr administration, those folks, when COVID ended, those folks were coming back. And it was that change of administration.
Coming back to prison.
Because unless, if they had more than 12 months left on their sentence, there was no legal authority for them to remain in the community. So they were looking at coming back to prison. And there was a lot of stakeholders, a lot of families, kind of chewed on the ear of the Attorney General and his staff. And they looked, and they did, you know, in their initial review of it, if you remember, or if you were like, I was paying attention to it because I was living it. The initial review was there's no legal precedent. Once the CARES Act ends, we're not going to be able to do anything. And it was after a lot of hemming and hawing and looking and research that the Attorney General decided that they could find the availability, the precedent, the legal statutes, the legal standing to allow the Bureau the authority to keep these individuals that were more than 12 months in the community. And that's huge. I mean, that was outside of FSA, outside of Second Chance Act. And I had during the course of the pandemic was actually talking to some OIG auditors, and the whole notion of these folks are still being monitored. They didn't understand that. And I think a lot of folks don't understand that. We just didn't drop people in the community and say, report to probation in 4 years. And we don't today. If they're in a halfway house or they're in home confinement, they are still serving a federal sentence and still have requirements, and we still have to keep tabs on them. I should say the Bureau. I'm retired now. I'm not a we. The Bureau still has to keep tabs on them. And I think a lot of people don't understand that.
And we're just seeing that now with this lack of RRC space. Now the critical mass has caught up and there are shortages virtually nationwide. We've talked about Baltimore and some other places that were just saying no. Just flat out. You had nothing coming on RRC placement. Now, hopefully that's lifted, but that was the case. And again, it was just sheer all the releases coming out and what was in the bed space. So that's why it's important to know, your first day of prison, your release is one thing, but if you're eligible, you're going to have something called a First Step Act projected release date, which is going to be months and months before what you think your release date is today. And so it's important to calculate that, correctly. I know there's a lot of people with these First Step Act calculators. Susan, you've seen them, and some of these kind of ex-cons. I got this calculator, and this is, they're making mistakes, right? And,
yes,
and we looked at the output, and so again,
they're kind of close, but they're not.
Not close,
and they're not close enough in terms of someone planning their life. And my concern, for folks to get their idea, their mindset on, oh, this is going to be my date exactly. And they get their mindset on that. And then they find out, well, wait a minute, this changed or this happened or whatever. The math wasn't carryover right. Day.
How they are in their carryover.
Carryover days.
Huge.
Huge issue.
Huge issue.
And because of that, I just think that's kind of yanking people's chains emotionally. When the Bureau developed the conditional release calculator, I was intimately involved in that and in the testing of that and running against different cases. And they're still trying, the Bureau is still working on, and or at least as of when I left a few months ago, they were still working on trying to refine that, particularly in those last few months, to be as accurate as possible, barring someone dropping out of earning status, presuming you maintain an earning status, trying to make that as accurate as possible, because the goal is not to get somebody's hopes up and then rip the carpet out from under them. I mean, that's just not how the Bureau works, despite what some folks out in the internet world might think.
Right. So again, that was one of the reasons why we wrote this book, is so that we could empower
you.
I'm sorry, man.
You're good with that, Bruce. You're good with that. I love it. You're just like Jesse Waters on his book, man. You're awesome.
Hey, man, it is what it is. It's the truth. I mean, but we're empowering attorneys, family members, and the inmates themselves. They can get the book delivered to their cell, from Amazon. What a country. So yeah. Through the mailroom. And so, man, we're giving this information for free. I mean, okay.
We also kind of included, we also, $14.99, not quite free. We've also given, we kind of walked through chapter by chapter, the different aspects of it, how credit is earned, how you fall out of earning status, things as of the individual you can do to monitor your credit. I even go through a pretty detailed section toward the end of the book about, being prepared for team and what you can do as the individual serving time to make sure things go right. Because sometimes errors happen, and it's not because, sometimes there's a glitch. But glitches, computer glitches, the technology is like this much, right? Humans, they're still human beings, very much involved in it. And then we walk through in the book the different types of errors that can happen. Some of them are very simple, and if they're identified quickly, can be corrected quickly with no impact for the offender. Some may take some more effort, and we have to get some more folks involved. But again, the goal is always, if something's wrong, let's catch it quickly, you know, because there's still people involved. There's still human beings that are still doing data entry. And I don't know about you, but sometimes my thumbs can miss a key.
Exactly. Hey, but another thing, Susan, bring up the person, the inmate that signs up for a class, but then quits the class and it gets jammed up. Yeah.
Right. So if a person's on the waiting list for a class, and then the class comes up and they decline it, they're in trouble. Like, that's what turns the faucet off. The Bureau's taken the position that a waiting list is not going to negatively impact the individual. If we didn't have a seat, if the Bureau didn't have a seat in the class for you because it was full and you have to wait to the next one, you're going to be allowed to accumulate programming days on the basis that you've agreed to sign up.
Status. Yes.
You're going to continue in earning status. And then when the day comes that you say, they come call you and say, okay, class starts on Monday. If you turn around and go, well, never mind, I'm not going to. Not only do you fall out of earning status as soon as it keyed, but all of that time, though, those programming days when you were sitting on the waiting list, because those programming days were allowed to accumulate in good faith, all of those programming days disappear because you only were being given them conditionally on the basis that you were actually going to participate. So if you think you're going to like dodge something, dodge that class because you don't really want to, you don't think you have an anger issue, but you think you're going to dodge it. If you got an anger issue, you're taking the class.
Yeah, don't do it. So, yeah, let's talk about front loading real quick. What is front loading, and why do they say that? Why is that such a
So good conduct time is front loaded, right? Congress said individuals serving federal sentences earn 54 days for each year of their sentence. Prior to the First Step Act, they earned 54 days for each year served, because that's what the law said. They amended it with the First Step Act, and so because the Bureau knows you are going to earn 54 days for every year you are sentenced, they calculate it and they drop it into your time, and that creates what's called the projected release date. That is your statutory release date, okay? Period, end of sentence. There's no conditions attached to getting those 54 days. They are yours and are yours to keep, and as long as you stay out of trouble, you will have them until you leave. First Step Act, those days are all conditional. It is about, what have you done for me lately? What are you doing? What were you recommended to do? They are earned credit, which means they're not there until they're earned. And they are earned every single month. So they come in little bits. So until you earn them, you haven't earned them. And because of that, they aren't front loaded. But what the Bureau did, and it's a help to both the offenders, so they have an idea of where could they release, but it also helps the case managers in terms of planning. It helps the residential reentry offices in trying to predict what their populations might look like, is they have created what the Bureau calls the conditional FSA release date. And that is the date that if you are eligible to earn, and you're in earning status, the Bureau is going to presume, for the sake of planning, that you're going to continue in earning status and that you're not going to do anything to mess that up. So they calculate in 30-day increments, roughly how much time credits you would earn and at what point you will hit 365 days. And so you know you're going to get that full 12 months, or in the case of individuals that have shorter sentences, how much credit they are going to get.
Right. And so that's important to know. And again, You can read it there. And real quick before we wrap up the show, 924C. I know.
Oh my gosh.
I hate bringing it up.
Yeah.
924C is a gun charge, and you're talk about it.
924C, you got nothing coming. I mean, that's what we used to say in the prison. You got nothing coming. It is statutorily prohibited from earning time credits, period, end of sentence. Get a lot of questions with Chevron being overturned. How is that going to impact it? It won't. It won't. Because Congress specifically said, listed 924C. Now, if you're serving time on a different 924, an A, a B, a further down the line, you're earning time credits. It specifically, and that was unique of the FSA to list specific statutes, which has created some other challenges, but we won't talk about that, at least not today. But the Congress went through a laundry list of specific statutes and penalties statutes which prohibit credit, and 924C is one of them. And I know there's a lot of folks out there that say, oh, we heard, and until Congress amends the law, and the president, whichever president it is, signs it, 924C is a dead issue.
It's a dead issue. But look, you can still go to a camp. You can still get a favorable halfway house and please program anyway, despite your...
Because you are eligible for other credit. There's other benefits that not a whole lot of people talk about because they're more interested in the time off. But there are other incentives within the First Step Act in terms of visits and...
Right.
You know, cash awards for completing programs and all kinds of other things.
All righty then. We got just about 4 minutes left. So, Susan, thanks for coming on the show today.
We just barely scratched
the surface of this stuff. Really do appreciate it. And, folks, Susan's part of the First Step Act group on Facebook. So you can ask a question there at the First Step Act. Early release from federal prison Facebook.
Where's the book?
It's right here.
Book is available on Amazon.
It's available on Amazon. So very please get the book. You'll just love it. But it's very informative. It's technical, but you know what? It's informative. And so
and it's also available in Spanish language.
Right. And again, folks that can reach me. Then if you can reach me, then I'll get Susan as well. And that's been working well. So, again, thanks so much for coming on the show today. And it's been
a pleasure.
Wayne, you got any last thoughts before?
Well, I'm just impressed. Susan, thank you so much. I mean, I've learned, I had no idea. And I got an edumacation.
I used to tell people that the First Step Act was my fourth child at the dinner table because I felt like we were living it 24/7.
Yes,
I can see that from listening. What I want to thank you for, number one, is your time, your service to me, your service to the country.
Absolutely.
And that really is. I never thought of this like that, but you really do deserve so much thanks from all Americans for the service that you've done and the passion you've done it with. So
thank you
so much and muchas gracias.
My pleasure.
Sounds good. Well, folks, there it is. Another fantastic show of the Concierge Coaches Show on LA Talk Radio. We're on iHeartMedia. We're on Amazon Audible. We're on Apple Podcasts. So please feel free to get one of those and see the show for free. That's right. You ain't paying Nathan. It's F-R-E-E. Also, it's available on the LA Talk Radio site. We have all of our shows there. You can download them or listen to them and view them anytime, 24 hours a day for free. I can be reached at conciergecoach.net or regarding this, federalprisonauthority.com. Wayne, how can folks reach you?
Wayne_515@yahoo.com.
Yes. Awesome. Okay, then. Well, that's a wrap. Everybody have a great week, and we'll see you next time on the Concierge Coaches Show on LA Talk Radio.
Adios.
Thank you, Sue.
Thank you.
Bye.
You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Wayne Fritz, only